On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 9/11 was a nightmare, but my guest today, security and political analyst John Mueller, says we should have snapped out of it by now. As bad as terrorism is, he charges, what he calls America's overblown reaction to it has been worse. Worse for our finances, with billions spent on defenses for sites that will never be attacked. Worse for our global standing, as a war response feeds the image of a rampaging America. Worse for our own liberties and reasoned state of mind, says Mueller, as what he calls the terrorism industry works to keep the nation in a perpetual state of fear. Critics say, come on. Mueller says, no, really. Up next on Point, making the case that we are driving ourselves crazy over terrorism. I am joined now from Columbus, Ohio, by John Mueller. He's chairman of the National Security Studies Department at Ohio State University, professor of political science there. His new book is titled Overblown: How Politicians and the Terrorism Industry Inflate National Security Threats and Why We Believe Them. John Mueller, welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Nice to be here.
We're going to hear pushback later in the hour from one of those you charge with overselling the nuclear terrorism threat, Harvard Security Don, former Deputy Secretary of Defense Graham Allison. But John Mueller, let me come first to you. What's the overblown face of America's understanding of terrorism?
Well, it just seems to be basically terrorism is a limited threat, certainly in its present incarnation. And the amount of damage that terrorists do, outside obviously of 9/11, has been really quite limited. The chance of an American or any other resident of the globe who lives outside a war zone being killed by international terrorists over an 80-year lifespan is about 1 in 80,000, about the same as being killed by an asteroid. Furthermore, since 9/11, the amount of damage being done by al-Qaeda types, al-Qaeda wannabes, al-Qaeda maybes, and so forth, has also been fairly limited, at least outside of war zones, maybe 200 a year. Now, that's 200 too many, obviously, but it hardly represents an existential threat to the West or to the United States or to anybody else.
On the other hand, I can imagine people listening to you right now and remembering 9/11 and saying, come on, John Mueller, how many 9/11s do you think we could stand in this country?
Well, other 9/11s would be really terrible, obviously, but even 9/11 doesn't justify the extreme fear that polls frequently indicate. If you take an incredibly horrible scenario, which would be one 9/11 every 3 months for the next 5 years, your chance as an American of being killed are about 0.02%. Now, that's actually pretty high, of course, and that is a nightmare scenario, to say the least, and the ramifications would be enormous. But even at that horrible scenario level, it doesn't justify 30 or 40% constantly being concerned that they're going to be killed in the next few months, which frequently you find on polls.
Are you asking for a superhuman level of tolerance of threat and risk? I mean, just think of a 9/11 every 3 months, for just 6 or 9 months in a row, and One hesitates to imagine what would happen in this country.
Yeah, that would be a horrible scenario. What I'm saying is that even under those extreme circumstances, your chance of being killed are rather small. That would obviously be horrible, and the ramifications of it would also be probably pretty horrible. But I'm just using that as an example, and obviously nothing remotely like that has happened. There's been no 9/11s for 5.5 years now, and there's been no terrorist attack anywhere in the world that remotely approaches that magnitude.
You write about the so-called, what you call, the terrorism industry right in your book's title. What do you mean by that? What's the terrorism industry?
Well, I think the terrorism industry is mostly a group of people who are acting extremely naturally, doing what they do, and they notice that there's this big fear that's been accelerated or created by 9/11, and they basically play on it, and what they do constantly is exacerbate it, make it even worse, and fear can be very costly. Among the terrorism industry are politicians of both parties, but obviously the Republicans and Bush are the number one culprits in this case, because it obviously works so well politically for them, and there's hardly any politician willing to say what I'm saying for fear he'll lose votes, and maybe they're right. There's also the media, which seems to want to, if it bleeds, it leads, and they certainly play on that a lot, hardly ever pointing out the chance of being killed is very small, never putting it in context, pretty much. There's also bureaucrats who obviously always want their budgets bigger than smaller, And then there's various people selling or giving advice to the United States, to the Department of Homeland Security, and it's very much to their advantage to keep the hype going. Obviously, if you've heard that the United States government is going to spend a lot of money on security cameras and you happen to make security cameras, you're not going to go to Washington and say, well, you don't really need my security cameras, but, you know, I'll sell them if you want. Instead, you can say, yeah, you really need, boy, you need even more security cameras than you think you need. So they're all acting very naturally. It's not a conspiracy. Politicians are acting like politicians. The bureaucrats are acting like bureaucrats. The pork barreliers are acting like pork barreliers. And the media is acting like the media.
You start out saying, making fun of examples of, I don't know, a water park in Florida, Weekiwachi Water Park or somewhere.
Yeah.
That's
Weekiwachi Springs, yes.
Weekiwachi Springs.
One of my favorite places, clearly.
Spending money on terrorism defense there is provocative, what you put out here. And clearly nobody thinks that every dollar that's been spent since 9/11 has necessarily been put in the right place or that the response has all been great. But let's just say for a moment... let's say you're right. What are the costs attendant to this? I can imagine listeners saying, well, we may have spent too much in the wrong places sometimes, but I'd rather be vigilant than let our guard down and be whacked again. So how do you tabulate the costs in a way that might speak to that view, John?
Well, you want to keep the risk as low as possible if you possibly can, but it has to be done in a relatively cost-effective manner. Also, the exacerbation of the fear basically causes problems and kills people. Between 9/11, 2001, and the end of that year, over 1,000 Americans died. That is to say, about a third as many as died on 9/11 because they drove in dangerous automobiles rather than flying safely in airplanes. Since that time, obviously, that number probably has increased. One of the reactions to 9/11 was ultimately a war in Iraq, which has killed far more Americans than died on 9/11. Fear also has problems of reducing life expectancy, of increasing heart disease and things like that. And it also seems to demand or make politically possible things that weren't before, such as throwing tons of money at every kind of possible niche you might find in the security apparatus. There's also opportunity costs. The United States a few years ago was under-supplied with influenza vaccine, in part because of spending so much money providing itself with anthrax vaccine. No anthrax has taken place, but but tens of thousands of people die each year from influenza. Similarly, as has been very adequately documented, the huge amount of effort after 9/11 put on first responders for terrorism took money away and supplies away and training away from first responders for natural disasters. And that was one of the reasons there's such a disaster after the disaster of Katrina. These have to be kept taken into consideration.
There's a lot to explore here. We've got listeners piling in pro and con on your view of things, John. Let me get one first from Glastonbury, Connecticut. Lenny, you're on the air with John Mueller.
Yeah, hi, Tom.
Hi.
I always felt that the so-called war on terror has allowed us to miss what are the real threats to our society. For example, the deep, deep divisions that exist within our society, economic divisions, divisions of class. There was recently a situation in Hartford where a group of young people were chasing another group of young people with weapons. And the group that was being chased sought refuge in an elementary school. Now, the kind of urban violence that exists in our society, I think, you know, can over time feed into the kinds of divisions that really we should be worried about.
But aren't those long-term things that, yes, those are American projects to work on, but what about the urban violence of the World Trade Center coming down, of the economic violence of Wall Street closed in the aftermath of that? I mean... Does that mean terrorism is not a real threat that we should be concerned about, Lenny?
No. I think it, of course it is a real threat, but it's not an either-or kind of thing. You know what I mean? I sometimes think we are led to believe by our politicians that it is just simply the war on terror which will eclipse everything.
We've got it. Let me take another call, if I may, before the break here, Lenny, and thanks for yours. Let me go to Jack in Boston. Jack, you're on the air.
Yes. Well, earlier your guest said that the Bush administration was kind of the culprit in this thing and in promoting this terrorism thing. But actually, it's the very success of the Bush administration in fighting terrorism now, which allows the Mr. Mueller's of the world to come and say it's not that much of a threat.
Easy to poo-poo it when it hasn't happened.
Yeah. Well, not only that, it was a very success. It was a threat. It was a very success of the Bush administration that made it less of a threat. So it's a no-win situation for Bush.
Right.
Here he succeeds in making what was a great threat less of a threat, and then the critics come along and say, well, it never was a threat.
Right. Jack, we hear it. Let me get a response here. John Mueller, you're just basically dumping on Bush for doing a good job of keeping the country safe. We haven't had that second and third and fourth big attack.
Yeah, but I think we haven't had much of attacks around the whole world, basically. And the idea that American security apparatus has been so perfect that no terrorist could get into the country or be inspired from within to blow something up is a real stretch. You basically have to believe that the government is basically perfect, and I don't think anybody believes that, particularly after the spectacular failure after Katrina. I do think the security has gotten better, but every year 300 million foreigners enter the country legally, every year. And the idea that they couldn't filtrate 5, 10, 12, 7 terrorists into that group or bring them across illegally among the thousands of people who come across illegally every year seems to be a massive stretch. So it seems to me, while I do give the Bush administration some credit for making things more difficult for the terrorists at considerable cost, it seems to me that the fact that there haven't been an attack is probably more likely the terrorists are not nearly as diabolically clever, dedicated, devoted, and numerous as they once were assumed to be.
Mm. The terrorism industry is a phrase that John Mueller uses in the book, and he uses it pretty broadly for some people in government, some in the news media, some in academia. And one of the people on that list is with us this hour. With me in the studio, Graham Allison. He's professor of government and director of the Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs at Harvard's John F. Kennedy School of Government, former assistant secretary of defense in the first Clinton administration. He's written a lot and talked a lot about the threat of nuclear terrorism. Graham Allison, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks for having me.
All right. So John Mueller is giving you a pop right on the chops here. You're in the index. You've got two lines in the index, Graham Allison. We've talked with you many times about terror threats, about the nuclear terror threat. It always seemed to be a real and reasonable threat you were describing. But what about it? Are you part of the terrorism industry?
Well, it's an interesting phrase, and I would say it's a provocative book. It makes some telling points. I think there's no doubt that there's some egregious examples of misspending in this so-called war on terror. There's no doubt that there's a industry and political stakes in hyping the terrorist threat. There's no doubt that the likelihood of an individual being the victim of terrorism is much less than many people imagine. But I would say, on balance, reading the book and looking at the argument, that in a word, it's overblown, if that's not...
there's the blowback. You throw the word back.
And I would say that in terms of the central propositions, it is more wrong than right.
More wrong than right because what?
Well, because first, with respect to how great and grave a threat to the U.S. is terrorism, particularly mega-terrorism, that is where thousands of people are killed, like in 9/11, or even nuclear terrorism, in which hundreds of thousands of people could be killed, I would say it is a real present danger as one looks at the competence of the people who conducted 9/11 on the one hand and their aspirations. Secondly, if you look at this series of attacks and attempted attacks since 9/11, there have been 33 major attacks worldwide. I mean, remember, there was a bombing of trains in Madrid in which almost 100 people died. There were the bombing of the subways in London. And then just last summer, a plot to blow up 10 aircraft leaving London, flying to the U.S., was interrupted. So these are people still working at the problem. And when I look and read what Bin Laden and Osama Bin Laden, what Bin Laden and Zawahiri, his number two, and others say about their nuclear aspirations, and when I watch and see what they're doing, I would say that this is a serious threat to Americans' security and well-being. I think that what I found particularly puzzling about the book, because I did look at the book, I had seen the article version before, is that the arguments that John makes about the Bush administration's pursuit of so-called global war on terror, many of which I agree with, are the weakest arguments it seems to me, against the Bush pursuit of war on terror. And the strongest arguments he leaves neglects. So I found the book puzzling in that respect.
We'll look at what those might be. John Mueller, let me go to you on this. Graham Allison still uses the language of great and grave threat, real and present danger, megaterrorism. I want to understand exactly where you're coming from. Are you saying that the threat of high-impact terrorism is not what we fear, or that a country as big and rich and powerful and populated as the U.S. could absorb megaterrorism and should be prepared to absorb it rather than building its whole life around terrorism with all the costs that that entails?
Well, my basic point, my disagreement with Graham basically, is I think he vastly overestimates the likelihood that this is going to come about. We've had warnings about terrorists getting nuclear weapons, as you can tell from his own book, going back to the 1940s. Terrorists or mafias were also a standard way of looking at it. I think the probabilities are very low, and if anything, they're probably going down. The FBI director Robert Mueller recently testified about terrorist threat, and he was downplaying the possibility that they get any kind of weapon of mass destruction, though he's still worried about startup groups and so forth. I do think I agree with Graham basically that that's one area where I think we should pump some money into, because obviously the consequences could be very horrible should it happen. I'm much less likely to think it is. My estimates of the likelihood are far lower than his. But I am in agreement that that was an area that we ought to pursue generally. I think basically the idea that these guys could put together these incredibly complicated weapons, transport them, set them off, is conceivable, but as Bernard Brody once said, the defense analyst during the 1970s, that we have these constant worst-case fantasies, and people come saying it's conceivable that something could happen, and of course they proved it because the very fact they said it proves it's conceivable, but that it's likely or that it's worth spending huge amounts of money on is very questionable.
So is your view then that we should be prepared because it could happen, but you're saying it's unlikely? That seems to suggest that the country should be prepared to absorb such a blow. Just be prepared to take it and keep on walking. Is that it?
Well, we should be prepared. We should be prepared to do that. Yeah, should it actually happen, obviously, be a catastrophe, be a horrible thing, the worst thing to happen since the Civil War, I would imagine. But the country would certainly recover, and it's not clear that it would be the end of the country, as a lot of people seem to say. That, in other words, it's not a existential threat to the United States. Its survival is not at stake. It obviously would be very bad and a great catastrophe, but we should be prepared to be able to handle it should it actually happen.
So if a government,
but my main point, of course, is that the probabilities are incredibly low that would happen.
But if a government in Washington adopted your view of the terrorism threat, how would its policies, ideally, again, in your view, be different from what you've seen under the Bush administration since 9/11?
Well, the main thing would be basically not throwing tons of money at every conceivable target. When we talk about Weeki-Wachee Springs, that's only one of 80,000 targets. Actually, some people say it's up to 300,000 targets that have been identified. The idea of trying to protect everything, every bridge, every McDonald's, every shopping center, is quixotic in the extreme, but you have lots of people in Washington coming up with something that would be a target. But everything is a target. WBUR could be a target. WOSU could be a target. WCBE could be a target.
So how would you do it differently? What would your security posture be?
Basically, try to deal with it in a measured manner with a sense of cost-benefit, spending some money. Generally, I think the thing that's working best is international policing, which seems to have laced in a fair number of people around the world, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, lots of other places, and to treat the threat for the limited challenge it basically is. I would also spend some money in Graham Allison's direction of trying to reduce the danger of nuclear weapons spread, which seemed to be happening very slowly anyway. Not be nearly as concerned about as he is about the fact that North Korea might get the bomb. He seems to want to go to war over that, in fact. Then also try to deal with the issue of fear, because fear is very costly. And if people are constantly in fear, it hurts them in terms of health, it hurts them economically, and it takes money away from other things. Two callers ago about crime, one of the reasons many police chiefs are saying violent crime is going up is so much money and so much of their effort is being spent chasing after terrorists, which they have not been able to find any of. So that the FBI now has its top priority. It's got like eight priorities. The top three or four are all about terrorism. And as Barbara Boxer pointed out, the bottom priority is doing something about street crime and gang violence, which is very common in California.
Okay.
And it's really questionable priorities. The point is, obviously, you could do everything. But in reality, what happens is money comes from one pot frequently. That goes into one pot has to come from a different one.
But is there such a thing as being too cool-headed here? I mean, you say, all right, 3,000 fewer than died in 9/11, 40,000 die in traffic accidents every year. And the implication is we deal with the traffic accidents and don't run around in circles about it. We just accept that. The implication seems to be maybe we should do the same thing with terrorism. But isn't there, when these attacks are so symbolic and so strategically targeted, is it really inappropriate to feel pride wounded? I mean, people die in traffic accidents, but if someone, you know, if a member of your family is deliberately killed to send you a message, is it just barbaric and old-fashioned to go out and kick some rear end in retaliation for that? Isn't there something fundamentally human about sending a message in response?
Yes, and what has to be dealt with in that respect is that those messages can be counterproductive. Obviously, kicking butt in Iraq came out of 9/11, and it's cost us far more than 9/11, by far, both in terms of lives and infinitely more in terms of money than 9/11 ever cost. So it's also not entirely clear that you have to overreact to bad cases of terrorism. If you take the two biggest cases of terrorism against Americans before 9/11, the reaction was really quite measured, and it worked politically. The first case was in 1983 when 280 Americans were killed, Marines were killed in Lebanon by a suicide bomber. Mm-hmm. Ronald Reagan was president. He basically said, I'd like to bomb something because I can't find anything to bomb. The American public said, yeah, I guess that's right. And he was reelected the next year, 1984. The Lockerbie bombing, which killed a couple hundred people, including a couple of students at the University of Rochester, where I used to teach, in 1988, the response of Reagan and then of Bush 1 was, we're going to go after the guys who did it. And they eventually caught them, and have them under in custody. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Professor Mealy,
it was not that they had to bomb something.
You're very cool-headed about this. You're a political science professor, but I wonder, maybe this is just an academic argument you make, but, I mean, the politics, in your book, you suggest that the U.S. was wrong to go to war, all-out war with Japan after Pearl Harbor. You even kind of poo-poo Pearl Harbor. Is that a way to sell this argument? I mean, Americans have a very strong historical memory of Pearl Harbor, and, you know, yes, the war was bloody, but I think the country sort of has come to the fairly firm conclusion that was one of those times and you've got to go out and do the necessary. If you poo-poo Pearl Harbor, how can people buy your arguments about 9/11 or even Wikiwachi Springs?
Well, in the case of Pearl Harbor, what I'm suggesting is that there was another military strategy in response to Pearl Harbor, which would have done the same thing, in other words, brought down the Japanese Empire at far lower cost to the United States. And my concern is that it wasn't even considered. Maybe it would have been rejected, probably would have been. But the point is that you're making this decision at this time, one of the most important decisions in the history of the human race, and you'd expect naively that people would consider all possible options, including more measured responses that would accomplish the same thing. Instead of sending 100,000 men to die, which is what happened in the Pacific War, there might have been a way to do it at much lower levels, and I outlined that strategy. The other aspect of Pearl Harbor, which is really interesting to me, is the overreaction internally. The idea that suddenly the Japanese were 20 feet tall, that they were going to somehow be able to attack California, for example, when they could have known at the time, and certainly we know since, the Japanese never had remotely the capacity to launch an attack against the mainland of the United States. There's also concern about the Japanese internally, and of course 120,000 of them were incarcerated, Japanese Americans or Japanese in the United States. There was also the same kind of hysterical fears. The fact that there's been no attack in California only means that the Japanese are waiting, biding their time to do it at a propitious moment. Mm-hmm. Even people like Walter Lippmann were saying that at the time. Mm-hmm. So the idea of something being and Pearl Harbor also proved to be the last one. That's about the opening phases of the war were about the only thing the Japanese did well in that whole war. So nothing planned after the start of the war went well for them. So it's an exaggeration of their capacity.
There's the perspective, listeners, and you can hear it. The book is Overblown. John Mueller is the author. Graham Allison, an expert on nuclear terrorism, is with us as well. And Graham, I know you've got a response, but so many callers. Let me turn to them for a moment. Sean is calling from Toronto, Canada. Hi, Sean. You're on the air.
Good morning, Tom.
Hello, sir.
great program. When I was in Pakistan, I used to listen to your program on the Internet.
Wonderful. Good to have you on the North American continent. What do you think, Sean?
I think your guest is absolutely right. I think this should have been a multinational police action. You have glorified these thugs who have now become local heroes.
Thugs like, are you talking Osama bin Laden or what?
Absolutely. Mm. And his cadre, and these are criminals, and you made them national heroes. You suffered a terrible tragedy, and I think in the heat of the moment, you overreacted. I would have looked at the British when they and how they dealt with their problem in the Irish under the IRA. Or
yeah, a little more stiff upper lip. But, Sean, let me ask you. I mean, we ignored Al-Qaeda for a long time, right next door, and maybe even in your home country, Pakistan, and look what developed there. You can imagine Americans saying we should have then, maybe even now, be more aggressive in going after Al-Qaeda in that terrain.
I agree with you. I think it has to be dealt with in an effective manner because it's too late to be Mr. Nice Guy. These people have phenomenal amount of funding, and it is all coming from Afghanistan opium trade. The first thing the Americans can do is buy all the opium that grows in Afghanistan and sell it back to the drug companies for legal use.
So buy the opium, but settle down on the fear factor, maybe. Sean, good to have you as a listener there in Pakistan and there in Toronto. Graham Allison, you're listening patiently to the conversation here. What are you taking away?
Well, I think that you asked the right question about Pearl Harbor, and I think that John, to his credit, has the courage of his convictions, and I think this helps us understand the core of the argument. In John's view, the reaction to Pearl Harbor was overblown. That is, we were attacked at Pearl Harbor. We went to war, a great war.
There might have been a better way.
And there might have been a better way. There might have been a different way. But in any case, maybe you just get attacked from time to time, and then you deal with it as best you can. Ditto, 9/11. 9/11 was, for most Americans, and I think for all politically conscious Americans, a existential event. Everybody can remember where they were on 9/11. The notion that we might take another 9/11 every 3 months.
But isn't existential event different from existential threat?
No, existential threat in the sense that for America as we know it can't live with a 9/11 every 3 months. It's just that's not part of our stuff. I think John's right that we need to be hardened to the possibility that in the future, from time to time, there are more, there's small terrorist attacks. We're not going to be 100% successful in dealing with them.
A little tape right here. Last month, two men were hauled into a Boston courtroom. They were accused of placing electronic light boards of a cartoon character waving his middle finger under bridges around the city. Police and some motorists thought the objects might be bombs. The resulting panic left traffic snarled for hours, fueled rumors of a terrorist attack. Boston Mayor Thomas Menino vowed to prosecute the two men.
The individuals who might be placing these bombs, or these packages, I should say, should be warned that this is a heavy penalty. It's imprisonment, 2 to 5 years for each one of them. So we're not playing around. We're throwing everything at it.
We're not playing around. We're throwing everything at them. You can hear the attitude. Are we driven by the right concerns, the right fears, the right issues? Rita's calling from Boston. Hi, Rita. You're on the air.
Hi. Glad to talk to you today. I just wanted to raise the discussion or point it in the direction of the Transportation Safety Administration and the cost that that's having not only to our pocketbooks as well, but also to our time and effort. And I'd like to just tell a little anecdote that happened to me a few years ago when I was traveling and in the process of going through the checkpoint in Boston, my laptop computer was damaged. Well, the next time I was going through, I was trying to keep my eye on my laptop, and I expressed that to the TSA agent. And I won't use the tone of voice with me, with you, but he turned around and said to me, "What do you think, I'm stupid?" And I just was so enraged as a normal pleasure traveler. I'm not a business traveler.
Yep.
And I can't imagine what it's like for those people that are on the road all the time the amount of time their companies have to spend getting them to the airport earlier, and then what they have to go through just in terms of energy and
cost. So your computer got busted, and you were personally offended by a harried security worker at the airport. But does that mean that it's wrong for us to have security at the airport when we saw what happened on 9/11, Rita?
I think that they're just misplaced. I think that we're putting the idea of safety beyond real safety. When one of the guests talked earlier about the liquid bombs or the potential of them in England, those were thwarted by good police work in England. It wasn't thwarted because somebody caught them at a checkpoint at the airport.
So you've had enough at the airport, and we hear it. Let me get another call here from Newport News, Virginia. June, you're on the air.
Hi. First, let me say I'm 75 years old, and I truly resent the president playing this up, and we have no backbone. What happened to us? We got to run and hide. Oh, my God, we can't conserve. We can't do this. We can't do that. I was a young kid during World War II. We had more backbone to stand up and say, look, we do support our troops, even though I disagree with the war. I support them 100%. My husband had 30 years and three wars.
Yeah, so you were in World War II, but when Pearl Harbor came, the country didn't sit down and say, okay, we'll take that. It went to war.
The country didn't even know. Half the people didn't even know where Pearl Harbor was. They didn't know where Pearl Harbor was. People
well, they knew. They knew before it was over. Are you saying we're too attuned to terrorism now, June?
They didn't break in on a news program and say Pearl Harbor's been bombed.
Well,
I listened to all those recordings and history things.
Yeah.
And that, but we have people that, my God, oh my God, we got such a hype. We're suspicious of everybody if they have dark hair. Look at what happened in Oklahoma City. Did we forget that that was a former Marine? Did we forget that he belonged to one of these white supremacy groups?
Homegrown terrorist. In any case, June, we've got it. A call for more backbone. Graham Allison, I don't want to argue this sort of gross question here too much, but surely there must be room for some attitude adjustment in this country. I mean, we took a big blow. We've responded to it. Now we've got 5.5 years under our belt. And part of what John Mueller is saying is, let's do kind of a gut check on where our emotions stand in response to threat. That doesn't seem to be such a bad idea for a conversation.
No, I think that's a good idea. And I think that what John's book does is remind us that the likelihood of an individual, any single individual American, being the victim of a terrorist act is very, very, very slim. The likelihood of future terrorist attacks upon the U.S., I think, is quite high. As we try to adjust our attitude, I think the main thing we're going to need to do is redefine the enemy in this war. Currently, the Bush administration has tried to conflate the guys that attacked us at 9/11 and Iraq. These are two separate subjects. This would be a little bit like if, after being attacked at Pearl Harbor, we decided that the enemy was evil people and we declared war on the Soviet Union, which we knew Stalin was more evil than Hirohito, to which the answer is we would be fighting off in all directions, confused, and given the role that the Soviet Union played in the defeat of Nazism, we would have probably lost that war. So I think a lot of the discomfort with the Bush administration's attempt to wrap this huge thing out there, which is called either, Islamofascism or Islamic Jihad or all Muslims everywhere or terrorists are everywhere and whatever Hezbollah and Hamas and Sri Lanka and guys in Indonesia are doing
all
is
evil,
all part
all,
of this
all, everywhere.
All this evil and so forth is absolutely exaggerated and confused. And I think some pushback to that in terms of attitude is just right.
John Mueller, how would you narrow and target our efforts if that's what you'd do?
Well, I agree with quite a bit of what Graham just said, of course. I should point out that immediately after 9/11, George Bush made a speech at the National Cathedral in which he said his goal now was to rid the world of evil. which, considering that he came in urging a humble foreign policy, that's really an amazing change. My concern in some respects, going back to what Graham said a little bit earlier, is that, and you also mentioned the phrase identifying the enemy, in some respects the enemy to a substantial degree is us. If it is really the case that there's an attack in the United States, the only way the United States could really be destroyed is if we did it to ourselves.
What do you mean by that?
Osama bin Laden can't tear up the Constitution. He can't stop us eating hamburgers or start learning North Korean for English. I don't know exactly what it means to destroy the United States.
He could certainly tear down Lower Manhattan. Nuclear reactors could be torn up.
But he can't destroy the Bill of Rights. We can do that. And so when people talk about this being an existential threat to the United States, a few bombs, even a few big bombs, can't destroy the United States, but we could in response. And that's the substantial danger.
It sounds like you're with June from Newport News. They're saying, more backbone, please. You quote Osama bin Laden after 9/11 saying, crowing, as you put it, America is full of fear from its north to its south, from its west to its east. Thank God for that, said yes. bin Laden. But what about the narrowing and the targeting? What would you do with our effort in response to what is not an unthreat?
Well, basically, the response is policing. That's what we have done, and that's the part, as I mentioned earlier, seems to have worked pretty successfully, and I'm very much in support of that. Basically, what June's talking about, backbone, we should remember the last four words of the national anthem are home of the brave. Maybe we'll have to change that. Other countries don't labor under that burden. With respect to the airport thing earlier on, we should also take into consideration the TSA's budget, the fact that if you are forced people to spend an extra half hour in the airport because of that, it costs the economy something like between $8 and $15 billion a year. In addition, if people are very inconvenienced in going to the airport, they don't fly short-haul airplanes. Instead, they drive. Some of those people are going to be killed.
But there you begin to lose me. I mean, I don't like waiting half an hour, but I don't want to get on an airplane that's taken down by someone wielding a weapon or even a knife. I mean, I'm willing to put up with some inconvenience, and $8 to $15 billion for the peace of mind it takes to travel, do business, see the country, see family. I'm willing. Am I a prisoner of fear?
Well, probably. The question is whether you really need that. I mean, huge amounts of money are being expended to keep a repeat from 9/11 from happening. In other words, somebody hijacking an airliner, controlling you for a while, then flying into a building. That's mostly what the air marshals.
Wasn't that a good idea? We don't want that to happen again.
Yeah, but it's virtually impossible, as we know from the fourth plane on 9/11. The passengers and the crew won't allow it to happen. You could still blow up an airliner, and you want to deal with that.
So take the metal detector down. Everybody, come on in. Carry your six gun. We're okay.
Well, actually, if there'd been six guns on airplanes on 9/11, probably the airplanes would never have been hijacked if people were allowed to carry arms, incidentally. But the NRA
is going to send you a nice note after this interview, John.
I guess so. But the point is that basically it's virtually impossible. It's not impossible to blow up an airplane, so you'd have to worry about that. But much of what's being spent on is not for blowing up an airliner, but basically taking it over. And it seems to me that it's virtually impossible for that to happen because of what happened on the fourth plane. The reason it worked in 9/11 was previously
other passengers would jump up and mob whoever tried it.
Yeah, it happened just 6 months earlier Muslims hijacked an airliner from Russia and they took it to. But what had happened previously is that when they hijacked an airliner, they take it to some sort of neutral place or something everybody get off free. So therefore, it's not worth struggling because you'd do more damage than just letting hijackers have their way. After 9/11, obviously, they will not allow that to happen anymore. So consequently, it seems to be close to impossible for spending nearly $1 billion a year just for the air marshals, who are mostly designed to handle that. And it's something that's extremely unlikely to happen. Hmm. And so it seems to me that we should be looking at these things in that respect as well.
So put our shoes back on and march straight on the plane. Michael's calling from Boston. Michael, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I agree with a lot of these points. The problem that I see is that with some of them, it looks like a lot of hindsight to me. In other words, it's easy to calculate the risks of getting killed by terrorists, for instance, right now, but, it would be very helpful to go back in time and tell them what the risks are and, what the consequences will be and how the world will go.
So what does that leave you, wanting to be ready, even if you get called a fearmonger?
Well, I feel that in an unfamiliar situation, you have to cover as many bases as possible. you can't just say, oh, well, you know, you can't cover as many. You have to, you know, you have to sort of cover some of them,
yep,
because only some of them are going to be attacked.
Michael, we've got a rough line there, but I think we've got the core of your point. Let me get another caller, if I may, from Hersenburg, Virginia. John, you're on the air.
Hello. I think we're doing a pretty good job with the war on terrorism, but the hype that they keep saying that Bush is putting on it, I think most of the hype is coming from the media itself, with the daily reports on deaths, and you know, we don't have that on in New York City, the daily report of the day of death due to traffic accidents or whatever.
Right. So you laid on the media, and let us look at that. John Mueller, if there's a hype machine, where's the heart of it? In the media, government, where's the greater responsibility in your view?
Well, I'd like to see somebody sometime put it in context. The Department of Homeland Security has on its front page of its defining manifesto that a terrorist could strike at any time, in any place, and with virtually any weapon. I think that's questionable in various ways, but let's buy that. If the next sentence said, however, your chance of being killed by a terrorist is very, very, very small, then at least it would be put in context. But we've had now, since 9/11, endless yammering about terrorism in the media, as well as obviously from politicians and others. And almost never does that come up. My favorite example of this was that Michael Moore actually did say it. I've been looking for people who've said this any place in the media. Michael Moore did say it in an interview, more or less in passing, on 60 Minutes. He said, Americans' chance of being killed by a terrorist is very, very, very small. And then Bob Simon, his interlocutor, said, yes, but no one in the world believes that. And both statements are true. So it seems to me that getting this thing under some degree of control, looking at the, Graham mentioned earlier quite mm-hmm. rightly that there have been a bunch of terrorist attacks outside of war zones over the last 5 years, but the total number of people, including London and Bali and all those things, and those are all tragedies and horrible, obviously, but the total number of people who have been killed is about 200 a year, as I mentioned earlier, and if anything, it's going down. So the idea that we're up against this monumental cosmic threat, which is going to destroy the United States, destroy Western civilization, destroy the state system, is constantly is being said by politicians and pundits, as well as in the media, I think is just a massive exaggeration.
Graham Allison, all right, then we heard you describing Iraq as misdirected energy, but come home, Graham Allison, to the States. Endless yammering, says John Mueller, but if you were to tighten and focus our effort, our concentration on this, if you were to, you know, make it more efficiently disposed at home, how would you tighten that focus or narrow it?
I'd go back to the perps that attacked us on 9/11. So go back to Al-Qaeda and its affiliated groups. It seems to me we did the right thing to take down the Taliban and the sanctuaries that they were providing for Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan. We then went wrong in letting Osama bin Laden get away, letting the leadership of the Taliban get away, letting them set up in Wajiristan, and then diverting over to a country that wasn't part of this picture.
So police target an attack abroad,
not just police,
narrowly.
Not mm-hmm. just police, mm-hmm. military. Mm-hmm. It was a military action that brought down the Taliban.
But you're saying focus more specifically on Al-Qaeda, but at home, would you loosen up? Do we have ourselves in a knot of fear here?
I'd
would
say
you change the security posture at home?
At home, for sure, we're such a target-rich environment that lots of the actions that are taken to protect this particular target or that particular target are dumb. So, for example, in the airline security space, I would focus on locking the cockpit door in such a way that people cannot enter it. The Israeli airlines mm-hmm. already do that. Mm-hmm. And for the rest of it, if people on an airline I would have the level of security at which you have at the airport approximately, but I'd say that you're not going to protect every group of 100 or 1,000 people. So that's impossible to do. And mm-hmm. the fact that they happen to be more interested in airlines, but I think on the other hand, the notion that in the effort in the war on terror, very large numbers of people have been detained and reviewed, and that there's a high level of surveillance that now goes on is not unrelated to the fact that lots of potential terrorist acts have been disrupted. Mm.
John Mueller, there's much more to be said, but just give us a sense of what kind of response you found to this. Are people saying, pipe down, John, join the fear line, or do you hear Americans saying to you, you know, you're onto something here?
Well, both. There is obviously is a controversial position. But I've been giving talks on this for 2 or 3 years, and I must say, when I began, I thought I'd be lynched. But the response has generally been not necessarily agreement, a fair amount of agreement, but a lot of people saying, yeah, this is a point of view we should be taking into consideration. It's a shame that it isn't out there in the discussion, I may end disagreeing with it.
You may you make us think twice, and we appreciate that. John Mueller's new book is Overblown. Thanks for joining us. And Graham Allison, always good to hear from you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.